Hello, you're listening to Book Night with me, Lee Chambers, and Alex Rouget.
Hello.
Hello. What have we got on the show tonight, Alex?
Well, tonight we have a bestseller show. We have best-selling chick lit writer Paige Toon in the studio with us, and we have an interview from Victoria Hislop, who you met last week. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, it was lovely.
Both those authors are brilliant holiday reads, fantastic escapism. What do you like to read on holiday?
Well, I always feel that your holiday read should sort of reflect your holiday, really. So it should be light and easy, a bit escapist, something to relax into. But having said that, I actually like to take quite weighty books away with me on holiday, so because I can get a run at them almost.
Like
I
physically don't go, really big, massive books.
Yeah, and quite
War and
big.
Peace.
Or just quite serious books sometimes that actually, you know, in normal life, I'm reading little bits here and there, and so I lose the thread. So I like to take something that I can really immerse myself in. And I know all around me people are reading quite light and fluffy books, and I understand that, but for me the treat is to just really involve myself in something and kind of get into the subject matter. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a mix, really. I know what you mean. I mean, still with my short story obsession. Short stories are quite good because, especially with the kids jumping in and out of the pool and you having to go, you know, rescue one who's stuck in a rubber ring, you know, it's good to be able to just dip in and out of something like that. But at the same time, yeah, the joy, or it used to be before children, was just reading all day one book and just becoming completely immersed. And so sometimes it's something like a thriller, because that does grab you quickly, so you know that you'll be quickly into that story and you'll be really into it. And then something else would be something like One Day by David Mitchell, I think was a recent holiday. I've read MJ Hyland. I've read also Philip Pullman, like young adult fiction is quite good because it's completely different to what I would normally read, and also escapist. So anything like that, really.
I know what you mean. Reading before children, that's a whole
different
show
thing, yeah,
in itself, isn't it? What a lovely experience.
Yes,
that was.
Yeah. So Paige, can we bring you in now? What do you read on holiday?
Well, I'm like you. I like a bit of young adult sci-fi, like the Twilight series and Hunger Games. Also, obviously, really like chick lit, because that's what I write. So Marianne Keyes, anything by her will always sort of take me away to another world. So yeah, that's probably my two sort of favourites at the moment. I'm reading Beautiful Creatures at the moment, which is, do you remember that?
Is it a movie?
Yeah, I never caught it at the movies. I missed it. But it's pretty good.
They are good because I think, like you say, they're something completely different to perhaps what you would normally read. But you are, if you've got that time to start reading it, you're perhaps less critical of, you know, I don't know, the fact that it's a young adult book, and you just let yourself go, and then it's a wonderful experience. So Paige, first of all, before we introduce you properly, we're going to play a track. What's the first track we've got, Lee?
Is Taylor Swift.
Why did you choose this?
22. Well, I'm 38, but you know, sometimes I feel like I'm 22.
Me too.
And
not
it's
say
a good
hold
current single. Yeah, well, it always gets me singing along to it. Yeah. So
it's good fun. Okay, great, let's hear it.
Like a perfect night to dress up like hipsters and make fun of our exes. It feels like a perfect night for breakfast at midnight to fall in love with strangers. Yeah, we're happy, free, confused, and lonely at the same time. It's miserable and magical. Deadlines, it's time. Uh oh. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 22. Everything will be alright if you keep me next to you. You don't know about me, but I'll bet you want to. Everything will be alright if we just keep dancing like we're 22. Ooh. 22.
listening to Book Night on Cambridge 105. We're all doing a bit of chair dancing, actually, there. All getting in the mood for our summer holidays. Paige Toon is in the studio with us. Paige grew up in Australia, America and the UK, travelling about with her Le Mans winning father, Vern Schuppen. She then worked on Heat magazine. Got lots of questions about that.
So excited about that.
Yes, very excited about that. Before embarking on her writing life, she now has 7 novels, amongst them the best-selling Lucy in the Sky. She's been compared to Marion Keyes and Lisa Jewell, both of whom rate her very highly. Cosmo say that she's fun, summery chick lit with bite. If you want escapism, Paige Toon is perfect. There you go. How do you feel about being the escapist?
Well, that's exactly what I look for in a book. So that's a massive compliment.
Okay.
How do you feel about the chick lit label, Paige? Because some people really don't like it. Some writers really rebel against it.
Yeah, I don't really know why, to be honest. I mean, I like chick flicks, and you know, that's like a, you know, a romantic sort of book or film aimed at young women, and so for me, you know, chick lit is exactly the same in book form, and you know, that's what I write. I write a sort of escapism for young women, so I've never had an issue with it.
Who is your reader then? How would you picture your reader?
I've actually got quite a wide readership. So I've got quite a lot of teenagers, and obviously I'm mainly targeting women in their 20s. Most of my heroines are in their 20s, but then, you know, I get readers contacting me who are in their sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, a lot of mums and daughters read my books, which is great. So it's really sort of widespread.
Do you feel like you're escaping when you're writing your novels? Because, I mean, I think I started your book, The Longest Holiday, within the first couple of pages. I felt like I ought to be on a sun lounger with
like
a cocktail.
Like on holiday, yeah.
Yeah, you do. It does immediately get you in that mood. I mean, when you're writing, is it the same experience? Are you feeling like you're escaping?
Completely. I mean, now, with my first book, I wrote it pre-kids. And I sort of had it finished and then fell pregnant, and all of my books in between have been with children just writing in baby nap times. And so that's kind of like, wow. You literally, like, they're asleep, run to the computer, tap away as much as you can, they wake up, you know, and then that's the end. But just my last couple of books, they've both been in school and nursery, and so I've actually have been completely able to re-immerse myself in the whole process of writing and, you know, listen to music while I'm writing. So yeah, so it's real escapism now.
How do you write with children?
Well, like I say, I mean, it used to just be completely during nap times. But now they're at school and nursery, I go and sit myself in a local cafe and drink tea, write. I've got my sort of 3 to 4 hours every morning. And and so it's fantastic. You know, I'm really able to escape from reality. I'm not sitting at home thinking I should be putting the washing in or anything like that. So it's the most productive I've ever been. It's the whole
I think when you have less time, in a way, you make it more productive.
Yeah,
don't you?
No, absolutely. It definitely focuses me a lot more. And I do tend to write my books quite quickly, so you know, that's helped. I mean, I'm much better at writing to a deadline. So, you know, I guess having kids helps that.
What sort of deadlines are you working to? I read somewhere that you have to write a book a year. Is that right?
Yeah, I write a book a year, but it almost always comes down to the last 3 months.
Well, that you have to write it in the last 3 months.
Yeah, oh, pretty much.
Because you think, I've got time, and you put it off.
Exactly. I find it really hard to sort of focus myself until it's like, oh my God, I've got to write, like, you know, 80,000 words in 6 weeks.
I hope your publisher's not listening, because they're going to say, right, 2 books a year, brilliant. Yes.
Well, you should say that. I think we're coming to that, aren't we? No, I am writing 2 books a year next year.
Oh, wow.
So
maybe we can talk about this a little bit now, that you've got a new project on the go, which is young adult fiction.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, my second and my fifth books, Johnny Be Good and Baby Be Mine, are about this girl who goes to work for a rock star, and he's a real bad boy, and, you know, sort of it all gets very messy. And anyway, she ends up with his baby, but she's still with another man. She's not sure whose baby it is. And anyway, in the second book, it all sort of comes out and into the open. But she does worry that Johnny, this rock star, might have other illegitimate children around the world. And it turns out that her fears are not unfounded, because in my YA series, it's about the 15-year-old daughter that he never knew he had.
Okay.
And her mother's basically passed away. And she finds out that her real dad is this mega famous rock star. It's a bit of a ordinary girl and extraordinary circumstances kind of series.
Excellent. So sort of in the territory of Jacqueline Wilson, who she writes about quite gritty issues for young people, doesn't she? And in that sort of area.
Yeah, I mean, I like my chick lit to be a mix of fun and lighthearted, but also deeper issues as well. I really, you know, I want people to really feel what the heroine's going through. So So yeah, there'll be, you know, most of my readers do tend to shed a tear or two, but also hopefully laugh, you know, when they're reading my book.
Absolutely.
How do you research those bigger issues? And do you talk to people who've gone through similar things?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. It just depends. I mean, a lot of the time you can just really imagine, you know, I really can put myself in someone's shoes and just imagine being in that situation. And, you know, I can find myself in tears when I'm writing, you know. I found it really hard in the fifth book that I mentioned, Baby Be Mind, when Meg has to tell her boyfriend that the son that he's raised for a year of his life is not his. And I mean, I was crying when I was writing that, you know, because that was really full on. And obviously, as a mother myself, you know, you can imagine how awful that situation would be. Mm. So, yeah.
Do the characters surprise you? Do you know what's going to happen, or when something like that happens as you're writing, is that new?
I'm always writing in the spur of the moment. Most of the time, I know pretty much where the story's going to take me. But my book before the current one, One Perfect Summer, I sort of, about 20,000 words towards the end, I thought, actually, I'm not sure that this is as clear-cut as I thought it was. I wasn't sure who she was going to end up with. And the last few pages of the book, like, actually wrote themselves. It was the weirdest, most surreal feeling, like, just to be in the hands of the characters and actually not really knowing what was going to happen. And I kind of wrote it and thought, I think that's the end. And then it didn't feel right. And the next morning I woke up and I wrote another sort of five pages. And it, you know, basically was all, oh my God, that's the end of my book. You know?
Wow, that's fascinating.
I get very involved.
Yes. Well, people do say that their characters come to life for them. I mean, you obviously have an affection for your characters because, well, they've appeared in other books. You've kept going with them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I always really like that. That's something that Marianne Keyes did when I read Watermelon, her first book, and then read Rachel's Holiday, and then suddenly there was this mention of Watermelon. It was like, oh my goodness, you know, that's the sister of her first character. And it was so nice to kind of know that character, things are still going well for her. And so I really wanted to do that. And when I wrote my second book, Johnny Be Good, I thought, I want people to know what happened to Lucy from my first book. And so I just suddenly thought, well, this character, Meg, could be the girlfriend of her stepbrother. So you see her and Lucy in the Sky just like in this tiny little cameo role, and then suddenly she's got a whole sort of book series sort of laid out in front of her. So I've continued that tradition, and it's something that my readers always tell me they really like.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet your readers enjoy that. They like not having to let go of a character and carry on with them.
Yeah, because I mean, I kind of feel like they're living, you know, and there's a little parallel universe of their own lives, and I sort of almost know exactly what's going on with each of my characters, even now.
Oh, wow.
They're listening to me on the radio.
Yes.
Oh, thanks for that, Paige. As we mentioned earlier, I met earlier in the week, I spoke to Victoria Hislop on the phone. Victoria probably doesn't need an introduction, but I'm going to give her one anyway. Her first novel, The Island, sold over 2 million copies worldwide. Her second novel, The Return, was a Sunday Times number one bestseller. And The Thread, her third novel, is following suit. Her books have been translated into more than 20 languages. We've split this interview into two, and the first part of this interview that we'll play now, I ask her very specifically about her three novels that she's written. In rereading your novels, it struck me they're all set in the past, and they're all set in a foreign country. Two are set in or around Greece. I just wanted to know what it was about those countries that particularly fascinated you.
I think we've got more, let's say, dramatic modern histories than the UK. The two most recent ones are about civil war. And I think what interested me about them, about the subject matter really, was what it was like for women to live through those periods. Because I think a lot of history books deal with much more masculine side, you know, what the men were doing and why these situations developed. I suppose my imagination is slightly more sparked by what it would have been like for women and children. And I mean, I haven't actually written very much fiction at all that's set in the UK. At the moment, it's never kind of inspired me.
They're all based around real life events as well.
Yes, they are based around historical events or situations. Yeah, and maybe that gives me more of a distance from them. Perhaps I would find it harder to write about things that have happened in my own country.
And how much liberty do you feel you can take with those events?
With the historical detail, absolutely none at all. You know, I don't move or manipulate dates to kind of suit what I want to happen. Sometimes that can be very restricting and frustrating. I think, oh, what a shame that didn't take another 3 years, because then this person could grow up. And, you know, I kind of sometimes wish that I could move dates around, but I never do. I mean, having said that, it's impossible not to take a position, not to kind of have a political view. And what I, because I didn't study history at reading very much at school and not at university. What I maybe hadn't appreciated before was how biased one way or another most political, most historical accounts are. In that respect, you know, I'm very aware that if I write, say, about the Greek Civil War, there'll be historians that don't agree with my position on it. So although I stick to dates and facts as far as I can, there'll always be somebody that says, oh, but that didn't happen because of what the reason you said it happened.
So how do you choose what goes in? Do you follow your instinct on that?
Yes, I mean, I definitely follow my kind of emotions. I think, well, if I'd been in Spain at that time, I wouldn't have supported Franco. And similarly with the Greek situation, which was actually much more, I would say, or less black and white than the Spanish Civil War, I still think I would have erred more towards communism. So it's fairly obvious from the way I write my characters, I hope, which side I would have been on.
And you've got lots of connections with the country now. You've been learning Greek. And
yes.
You've got a house out there, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So you must feel a responsibility when you write about Greece to get it right and to the people.
Yes, no, I do. But in spite of that, I sometimes find myself having conversations with people there and thinking, I think I'd better curtail this conversation because I'm sort of rapidly going off certain people there because I realise that they are much more right-wing than I find comfortable to sort of discuss.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I do. It's definitely not a responsibility. It's almost a nice byproduct of what I do now that, you know, I hope that people who read my books about Greece will want to go there. And generally, I think I don't try to write positively about it. I just sort of naturally do because I love it so much. But I nevertheless think people ought to know about sort of truth, the reality of a country when they go there on holiday.
And your books aren't just set in a different country, they're set in a different time. So it's quite challenging to research. How do you do that? Where do you start with something like that?
I spend a huge amount of time in libraries. For three of my novels, I've researched for about 2 years before writing them. And we're very lucky in Britain. I mean, I go a lot to the British Library, also the London Library. And in Athens, you use a photo archive, but photographs are wonderful sort of shortcut to learning about a period. You can tell an awful lot from how people were dressed and what's going on in the background, and generally the social history is very clear from photographs.
And do you subscribe to this view that writing about the past can throw a light on the present? Because the Greece you often write about is going through a very turbulent time, and of course current day Greece is also going through a very turbulent time.
Yes, no, I really do. I think part of a pattern absolutely connected with what's taken place before in recent history, definitely. And I'm fairly kind of critical of Greece itself because I don't think that people there necessarily know their own history, you know, for kind of understandable reasons. You know, they had a period of dictatorship during which history was not taught objectively by any means whatsoever. So a lot of people who are now adults have a very warped kind of version of what's taken place in their own country. And so I don't think it's easier sometimes to see the connections between events and to see history when you're slightly distant from it. But a lot of people in Greece, I don't think they're too close to it. They don't.
But your books are very popular in Greece, I understand.
Yes, yeah, they are. Yeah, I mean, a lot of nice people write to me and thank me for telling them their own history, which is the greatest compliment of all, I think, that I could have.
And how do you find the stories that you've written about? What is it about something that you hear or see that catches your eye and you think there's a novel in there?
It's usually something that I see in the street, the thread maybe is the kind of most obvious example. When I was in Thessaloniki, I noticed that there was a abandoned minaret. And although there are a few scattered around Greece, you know, I hadn't really been aware of their connection with Turks and what had actually taken place there. The fact that at one time Thessaloniki had had more mosques than churches, and they had been, the minarets by and large, had been destroyed after the Muslims left in 1923. So it's usually something like a sort of physical monument to something, bricks and mortar. you know, why is this here? I mean, the same with the island. I mean, that was a sort of whole little village of abandoned houses that intrigued me, and that was the starting point for that story. And for The Return, it was, again, it was a monument, oddly enough, in Granada to someone that I knew had been a supporter of Franco. And it's a very grand, like a memorial to this person that I had already read was a fascist. And I thought, that's really strange, because my vague understanding of the Spanish Civil War, see, Franco won it, but then since then, people have recognised that, you know, Franco was not a good thing. He was a dictator. So I was slightly puzzled. So it's often something, a physical thing, rather than something I hear.
Victoria's talking a lot there about being inspired by place and setting or physical things. Your books do have a strong sense of place as well. I mean, I was transported to Miami. Did you go there to research?
Yes, yeah. Basically, every single one of our family holidays every year is centred around where we decide to base my next book. So, it's like, where should we go this year? Key West would be nice. Okay, let's base a book there.
Oh, okay, fantastic.
You've grown up all around and you've got all these different national influences in your life. Do you think that has played a part in your writing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a couple of my books have been about being torn between Australia and England, which is the two places where I spent most of my time growing up. Most of my books are either set primarily in Australia, England or America, but usually they go somewhere else as well. And it just is so much easier to write about when I've been there.
Mm. I mean, it's a corny question, but where do you get your ideas? How do you decide what you're going to write?
I don't know. Sometimes an idea will just pop into my head, and usually it happens when I'm writing the book before, and then that just idea just keeps sort of spiralling and you know, going further. My dad used to be a racing driver, so that inspired my third book, Chasing Daisy, because she works in the world of Formula One. Lucy in the Sky, my first book, was about a girl torn between two countries and two men, and that was inspired by me being torn between England and Australia when my parents moved back to Australia and I was still in England, and you know, kind of felt like I was sort of really split. Johnny Be Good, about the whole rock star thing. I used to work at Heat magazine, so I used to write about these sort of bad boy celebrities, and ideas usually just sort of pop into my head, and it might even be from watching a film or something, you know, and I think, oh, I love that story, you know, imagine if this had happened, and then suddenly it's sort of, you know, and a whole other idea spirals out of it.
So getting to Heat then, that's what we've been waiting to ask you. So tell us about your time working there and what you did and the sort of people you met.
Spill the beans. Come on, give us some celebrity secrets.
We basically want some gossip. No one's listening as well.
an exclusive.
Not really on radio. Having a little cup of tea. I worked there for almost 8 years. I was a reviews editor, so I used to deal with all the film, TV, book reviews, music reviews. So that was, you know, that was my bag. But obviously we would hear gossip from the news desk and, you know, we'd sort of say, what's the lowdown on such and such, you know. But yeah, my editor was always really good about only putting things into the magazine that he had a real true basis in fact. So most of the gossip is actually in the magazine.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. It's a celebrity. But good parties, I imagine.
Oh, it used to be fantastic. God, I'm quite nostalgic for those days, I have to say. Those pre-kids days, you know, when we used to just be able to go to any film that I wanted to see well before its release date for free, you know, go to book launches at these amazing locations, you know, sort of up high looking out across London, drinking a glass of champagne, and yeah, obviously loads of parties, yeah, like TV launches and things like that. We've had some very fun times.
And who's Johnny based on then?
You're not going to tell us. I got the idea for Johnny actually from a book that I read about Robbie Williams by journalist Chris Heath, but Johnny is not like Robbie, I don't think. You know, he's certainly not meant to be. In my head, he looked a bit like a sort of a bit of a cleaner cut Kurt Cobain kind of character. But certainly, the idea came from reading that book about Robbie. And, you know, this journalist basically becomes friends with Robbie. And I was just sort of thinking, imagine that, you know, if you were like writing a book about a, you know, major, major pop star and was sort of transported into that world by default. And he talks about his PA and how much he has to trust her to deal with all of his personal business. And I just thought, well, that would be pretty nuts, you know. So that's what gave me the idea for Johnny Be Good.
That's a hell of a job. Robbie Williams, PA. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Oh, yeah. I can, yes. I'd like to spend a lot of time imagining that.
You get to, like, travel the whole world and be backstage at all the concerts and stuff. It would be pretty nuts.
Yeah, it would be mad, yeah. Well, it's your next piece of music now, which is Mickey Echo. Why this one?
I love this song. I think I listened to this over and over while I was writing my latest book. So yeah, it's just one of my favourite songs that's recently come out.
I heard you were trouble, and you heard I was trouble. But your name is a wave washing over me. No games, just a slave to you totally. Cause I don't care what they say about you, Virgo. And you don't care what they say about me, Virgo. But you know what they say about trouble. Pull me down if you want to, and I hope that you won't. Crack, two punk kids up against the world. Yeah, trouble, there goes trouble. We could be king and queen of the moonlight. Two young lovers, and when the mood's right, you hear me say, I want you to pull me down if you want to, and I hope that you want to.
Studio. It's book night. We've got Paige Toon in the studio with myself, Lee Chambers, and Alex Rouget. And Paige, you're going to read for us now.
Yes.
What you're going to read from?
Well, this is my new book, The Longest Holiday. It's about halfway through the section that I'm going to read. And basically, the heroine has gone on a girl's holiday because her husband has done something truly unspeakable.
Oh yes, I know. Yes,
yeah. So I mean, she finds out that, so 7 months into the marriage, that he had very drunken sex on his stag do and got the other girl pregnant. So there is now going to be a baby that she's, you know, her husband's going to be the father to for the rest of his life. And she's just horrified by this prospect, obviously. And her best friend Marty drags her away, and basically she goes on this holiday, is immensely attracted to this really hot Cuban scuba diver.
Yes, I remember him as well. It's all coming back.
Called Leo. Yeah. And at the end of the holiday, she doesn't want to go home again. So she stays in Key West Her friend Marty is now really trying to persuade her to come back to her husband, Matthew. And yeah, that's basically where this sort of sits.
That's where we start.
Yeah.
Okay, lovely.
All right, ready? "You don't love him, do you?" she asks Riley. "No," I reply quickly, although inside I'm not so sure. My emotions are not that clear-cut, and I'm not quite sure how to separate love from lust. I guess I don't know him well enough to love him. "Then what on earth are you doing?" she demands to know. I sigh heavily and try to explain. I just know that I don't want to go home yet. I don't want to say goodbye to Leo yet. I can't let him go. "Maybe it'll be a good thing if he lets you go then," she says. "Would you stop saying that?" I raise my voice. "Damn it, Laura!" Uh-oh, no nonsense. Marty is here. "Your holiday visa is going to run out in what, a month and a half? You're going to have to go home then, so what on earth are you doing, screwing up all your chances and making things work with Matthew? I know he messed up big time, but he's sorry. He made a mistake. He still loves you, and I know that you love him, so stop screwing him over." "So now you're on his side," I cry. "I'm not on his side," she cries back. "I'm on your side, both of your sides, the two of you as a couple." "But Marty," she interrupts. "You know, we did sit there, all of your friends and family, in that church, under the eyes of God, while the vicar asked us to support the two of you and help you through difficult times." "Under the eyes of God?" I say with disbelief. "Since when have you been particularly religious?" "Watching you get married was the most religious I've ever felt, if you want to know." Her voice goes up a notch to drive home her point. "There was something about that service, something so serious. You'd been through so much." Now she sounds choked. "Don't cry," I say sadly. "It's true. Seeing you standing up at that altar with him, seeing the look in his eyes as he promised to love and honour you, in sickness and in health and all that other stuff, it brought tears to my eyes. It still does. Matthew loves you, Laura. You're not going to find another man like him. I know you fancy Leo. God knows I fancied Leo and Bridget sure as hell did. But where's your future with him? You can't base a relationship purely on sex, you know, however good it is." "It's not just the sex," I say firmly. She laughs at me, a hostile laugh. "It's not," I exclaim, trying not to let my temper take over. "There's more to him than that." "Come on, this is short term and you know it. We're not 18 anymore. This is not Ibiza." "No shit, Sherlock. I'm 29, not some idiotic teenager." This snub is meant to irritate her. "I'm just saying that maybe this is not temporary. Maybe I do have a future with him here in the Keys." "You're not a bloody banyan tree," she practically shouts. "You can't put your roots down wherever you like." "Shut up, Marty," I snap. "Now you're really annoying me. I told her about the banyan trees, and now she's using the damn things against me."
Thanks for that. That was great. I mean, that really emphasises that your books are really about women's issues and women's thoughts and concerns, and they often do revolve around a love story or a relationship of some kind. How do you not make that corny? You know, how do you give it some life and pep and not make it sort of soppy and unappealing?
I think because, like you say, it's I try to make it as realistic as possible. So there's always light and shade. You know, there's not sort of, it's not just straightforward issues. I mean, the whole fact about, you know, finding out that your husband is going to be a father to somebody else's child that should be your child in like a couple of years. And the whole thing with Laura is that obviously she's thinking, I'm not sure that I can ever forgive him for this, you know, because I'm going to have a constant reminder. But in the same sense, her husband, you know, they did have a really good relationship. He did make a terrible, terrible mistake. And all of her friends and family are saying that she should forgive him and you know, go back to him and that she could actually be a part of this baby's life. You know, that it's not the baby's fault. You know, that she actually could be a good role model for this baby and that they could move forward from it. And she's absolutely shocked and horrified at this one point when she finds out that her mum has actually met the baby and she just feels so betrayed. So it's not, I mean, all of my readers say, almost all of them do say that they're not sure at the end who she's going to end up with.
Absolutely.
Because it's not that straightforward. And sometimes, you know, my books, the heroine ends up with readers that, with the man that the readers don't want her to end up with. So I try not to make it predictable, even though obviously there's a certain element of predictability in every chick lit novel. But yeah, so I do try to, you know, sort of give it a bit of extra
oomph. Yeah. I mean, I really like that because she was indecisive between two men, but there wasn't a bad guy and there wasn't a good guy. You know, they each had their pros and cons. So as a reader, you're putting yourself in her shoes. Presumably that's what you want, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly try. I write in the first person present tense. So for me, I'm right inside the heroine's head when I'm writing this. And I really sort of pause sometimes and think, how would you feel if this happened to you? And obviously try to convey that with words. And so that's the thing that my readers tell me they like most about my books, that they feel like they're inside the heroine's head too when they're reading it, so they're crying and laughing with her.
Yeah, they're there as well. Yeah.
Do you have to work at the tension in terms of when you're getting towards the end of, going, I've noticed in this book you go to a different character to sort of delay it. Is that something you really consciously have to do?
No, normally they kind of like carry on at a very sort of fast pace and it, you know, it just sort of reaches that final climax. And I always have an epilogue because I like to let people know what happened after, you know, what happened after the happy ending. Or not necessarily happy ending. But with this one, it was funny because a lot of readers have written to me since and said, I did not know where you were going to go with the story because I was kind of wrapping it up. And then suddenly there's this big twist. And so that wasn't to delay. I mean, that was always, I always had in my head that I was going to write a big chunk of the ending from another character's perspective. It's something that I've never done before. And yeah, so far it's gone down well.
Well, we'll come back to your page and ask you all about your writing process. But before then, I did ask those questions of Victoria Hislop. So here's the second part of that interview. What's your writing routine? Do you have a routine?
I'm at my desk, usually it's about 9:30. And quite what I do at my desk will vary, you know, day to day, whether it's researching or actually writing or dealing with, you know, a lot of paperwork that seems to arise now. I have different countries around Europe where my books are coming out at different times. And let's say The Island at the moment is very popular in France. So I'm having to do various promotional things connected with a book that I wrote, say, 7 years ago now, that I kind of thought that I'd put away, but it pops up again.
Is it quite hard to get back into the headspace of The Island when you're writing something else?
It is a little bit. Yes. It is a little bit. And I sort of feel, in some ways, that I shouldn't be doing that because I should be, I'm much always, if I'm honest, more interested in the new thing, in what I'm trying to do for the future rather than something that I did 7 or 8 years ago. But it's, you know, nevertheless something that's to be done, and I'm lucky to have to do it, really.
And when you're starting a novel, where do you start? Because you've obviously acquired a lot of research by the time you come to start. Do you spread that out on the desk, or has a story suggested itself usually during the research?
Yes, I'm usually all the time sort of imagining some characters planted in, you know, who would my characters be in this situation. And I always begin with a very detailed synopsis, always my starting point. It isn't, when I write short stories, it's sort of different. It's much more organic. I can literally just write a sentence for myself and then the story grows from that. But with a novel, it's got to be, you know, much more structured.
Yeah, so you begin with a synopsis. You're not one of these writers who just lets the characters take them where they want to go.
No. I mean, having said that, sometimes you do halfway through have to really assess who your character is. If they seem to be doing something that you put in the synopsis, that actually when you're writing the detail, putting the sort of flesh on the bones, maybe it doesn't ring true. So they do sort of come to life in a very kind of satisfying way sometimes. So they kind of tell you what they want to do, but not always.
And have you ever got to the point in a novel where you've thought, this just isn't working, and had to discard some words?
Not yet. I'm sure I will do. To date, no.
Oh, is that the synopsis? Happened. That's when the synopsis comes into its own, I guess.
Yes, it is in a way. I mean, the synopsis got to work, even if you end up sort of digressing from it. The initial sort of idea, I think, has to be fairly watertight.
How do you decide to structure the stories? Because I notice you use flashbacks quite a lot, I think, in all three novels. Flashbacks are central.
I mean, I quite like not to. I don't kind of deliberately set out to do that. I think it's because I'm looking at these sort of historical events. In those three books, I've needed like a framework, like a justification for writing that story. So that has to be somebody in the present who is discovering their own connection with those events. So it's almost like the events are being revealed to somebody in the present. And in the end, the revelation of that history will probably do something that certainly changes their own perspective about their family, but probably changes what they're going to do themselves in the future. And that's why I've used the modern framework, because I wanted to kind of maybe show how one's own kind of family history, why it's important for now. I'd love to write something where I didn't do that. I've just never quite grabbed the thing that allowed me to do that.
And you've said in the past that despite three best-selling novels, you still don't feel like a novelist. Is that still true?
Yeah, no, my magic number is 5.
Why 5?
5. I don't know, really. 3 is sort of my lucky number, but I just feel 5 is more substantial. And when whenever I open any of my favourite writers to read, you know, their latest work, you know, Ian McEwan, you go, my goodness, you know, pieces, you know, 40, a list of 40, and it looks really substantial. And I think, yeah, he's a novelist. You know, most people I admire have written an awful lot more than I have.
Are you still learning, do you think?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Gosh, I hope so. I mean, I definitely hope my books get better. They may not sell more as time goes by. You know, I might sell less as I get towards my 10th novel. I might be selling 300 copies, but I hope that the writing will be better.
Do you think the writing has got better as the novels have gone on?
I hope so. Yeah, I think I've learnt more. I want to, you know, maybe take more risks, be more adventurous with how I write. But definitely writing style changes.
And The Island was made into a mini-series.
Well, mini. It was 26 episodes.
Oh, not so mini, no.
Oh, no. It was rather maxi.
How was that, seeing...
That was an amazing experience. I mean, it was... It took about sort of 2 years of my life because I was very connected with it. I was very determined they shouldn't just not wreck it, but a lot of my writer friends have had their works made into TV or film, and by and large, they've done nothing but moan about it afterwards. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be like that. I had it in my contract to have script approval and casting approval and approval over music and just about every way of controlling it as I could. And so having kind of got that, I then had to fulfill my part of the contract, which was to sort of be there and pretty much supervise what was going on. And because it was all in Greek, it meant I had to learn Greek. So it was all a bit of a task. But the end result was really beautiful. And we're sort of very trying to get it into Sky Arts at the moment. So we're kind of hoping that they will show it on UK television.
So fingers crossed we'll be able to see it, hopefully.
Yeah, it would be really nice because it's well up to sort of international standards.
And your books, the cover of your books, they all look very similar. Do you feel, and it's not a criticism, but do you feel you've been branded in a way? And is that necessarily a bad thing?
Not really. I think it means that if people have read one of my books and liked it, then when a new one comes out, they'll kind of go, oh, yes, that's her again. I mean, this does happen to a lot of authors, that they get a style. The publisher would probably call it, I think, it's not meant to be a straitjacket, really. I suppose if I wrote a very different kind of book, you know, if I just rang them up one day and said the next one is a futuristic novel set on an unnamed planet with, you know, robots, I'm sure they would go for a completely different style of cover. They'd probably be a bit shocked if I told them that.
Panic, but, yes, probably.
I think they would, you know, I think the covers, I particularly love the cover for The Thread. And I think even if the covers for The Island and The Return never existed, the cover for The Thread is perfect for that particular story. So, and in fact, they are done by different designers. Yeah, no, I've been very happy with them. Some of my overseas covers are extremely different. They're really, you know, quite extraordinarily, shockingly different sometimes. Almost, well, one of the cover, the Turkish cover for The Island, is an incredibly, very sexy-looking woman with an off-the-shoulder dress, pouting, you know, at the camera. I mean, you wouldn't think it was the same book. So, you know, there are other ways of treating the same material.
And one final question, Victoria. What are you writing at the moment? Are you able to say?
At the moment, I'm just finishing another little group of short stories. I've got slightly addicted to writing them. And I had one collection that came out at the end of last year and is just about to come out in paperback, which is The Last Dance. So I'm just writing few more, hopefully, to kind of work towards another collection of them. And I'm also researching another novel, which will have Greek theme, unsurprisingly. Surprise, surprise. But hopefully the cover might be a little bit different this time.
Well, there's lots to pick up on that interview with Victoria there. I'm really interested in hearing her say that she doesn't really call herself a novelist now that she's written 3. She's going to wait till 5.
I know, it's amazing,
five.
Isn't it? Yeah, 3 best-selling novels and she still doesn't feel she's a novelist.
At what point did you feel accept that you were a novelist, Paige?
Oh, within about, I don't know, 2 seconds of getting a book deal. I was so excited. Yeah. I was so excited. We were going to Australia a couple of weeks after I'd just signed, and that's where I researched some of my first book. And I remember we had to put down the immigration form, you know, what occupation you have. And I sort of looked at my husband, he was like, do it. I was like, author.
So how did it happen, the process of you, you know, scribbling away, thinking I've got a book here, and then getting accepted?
Well, it kind of didn't happen like that. I was incredibly lucky. I had the idea for Lucy in the Sky about this girl who gets onto a plane going to Australia, and she gets a text message from her boyfriend's mobile just before takeoff saying, I've slept with your boyfriend 4 times this month. And then the air hostess tells her, switch off your phone. And she's just like, has this horrible sort of 24-hour flight thinking her boyfriend's cheated on her. And anyway, I told this idea. I was just having lunch with someone from Simon & Schuster who had become a friend through my work at Heat. And he was like, you should write a book, love. You know, you get a book deal easy, which is not actually true. But anyway, I told him the idea for Lucy in the Sky, and he said, I love it. And he said, I'm going to tell my editor. And 5 minutes after getting back to the office, I had an email from her saying, I'd like to meet you. I really like the idea. And literally, it was about 9 days later, I had a 2-book deal, and I'd only written a page.
So wow.
It doesn't often happen like that, but I did end up writing that book in 2.5 months and just loving it.
The killer idea does seem to be the thing. I mean, they often say now you need to be able to say in a sentence what the book is about. And is that what you aim for with each book? Do you think, okay, I need to be able to distill this into something as great as that?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of a very, very catchy idea. And since then, the ideas have evolved and they're not quite as easy to be able to, you know, pinpoint into a sentence. But it's definitely, I mean, it's what I've said to so many people who've asked about writing a book, you know, just to come up with that idea, that hook to get you published, to get you through the door. And it definitely helps if you've got a journalism background, because, you know, you're already a writer and, you know, you've already got that sort of credibility. So I think that's another sort of something for people to think about if they're trying to get published, you know, to maybe look at going into it a different way, you know.
I was going to ask you after your reading, we had a little bit of tantalising of the sexual content in the sexual, does sound like Miranda. Yeah. And there is it's not a blockbuster, it's not loads of sex, but there is obviously a bit of sex in there. And I was just wondering, after the whole 50 Shades phenomenon, you know, has there been more pressure to include more sex in a chick lit book? Do your publishers say to you, come on, let's ramp it up a bit?
No, they haven't said that at all. But it was funny. I kind of did ramp it up slightly. I think just naturally, you know, it's sort of, yeah.
There's obviously a market for it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's not, you know, like it's still not, you know, a blockbuster by any, yeah.
No.
It's still sort of, I mean, you know, my mother-in-law is going to be reading this book.
You're
thinking
about
that. So I've
kind
of always got that in the back of my head.
It's a lot more about anticipation, which I think people love reading about, don't they?
And that's what I love reading about. You know, I like the sort of long looks and the, you know, the sort of sexual tension building. And then obviously, you know, you have that big woo, let go.
Big woo.
The woo, yeah. We like the woo.
And Victoria spoke there about she writes with a synopsis and then she sticks to that synopsis, unfailingly by the sound of it. Is that how you write? Do you plot it all out chapter by chapter?
Yes, yeah. I don't do it chapter by chapter. I just do, you know, just a couple of pages just to say how the book's basically... And I need to do that for my publisher because they have to sell it into the trade without, you know, necessarily waiting for the book to land in their hands. So I always do that anyway. And it does help you kind of think about where the book's going to go, you know, who her friends might be. But the book always ends up, you know, going off on tangents and... you know, take on a life of its own.
But do you roughly stick to that synopsis usually?
Pretty much, yeah. Because, I mean, the idea has been in my head for a good 6 months while I've been writing the book before. So it's had time to develop and, you know, sort of organically kind of develop in my head. And it doesn't really, I don't tend to digress from that very much.
And do you feel you've been branded? I talked to Victoria there about being branding. Do you feel that you've got, you know, your typeface is always the same and each novel has a look and do you mind?
They've actually just completely repackaged all my backlist. So all of my books now I definitely feel like I've been branded now. But it's been an evolutionary process over the course of the last 7. So but now I think, you know, the way they look now, if you see The Longest Holiday on the inside cover, it has, you know, all of the books and they do look very, you know, kind of, they're on the same sort of font and different sort of colours. Yeah. I think they're really pretty. I'm really, really happy with them.
Okay, so we've got another piece of music from you now, I think.
The Killers.
Yay!
When you were young, why did you choose this?
Well, this one will always remind me of my first book. It came out around the time that I was writing Lucy in the Sky, and it just, yeah, really sort of sums up that feeling. So it always makes me really happy. Every time I hear it, I sort of remember happy times.
The Killers, and we're back in the studio with Paige Toon. Paige, I've saved my most shallow question for last, because Paige Toon, I was thinking the other day, does sound like Paige Turner, as in the book's a real Paige Turner. So is Paige Toon your real name?
Yes.
It is?
It is.
Oh, you were destined to be a writer, weren't you?
Well, no, because my maiden name is Chupin, so I was Paige Chupin, and I married a man called Greg Toon, and, you know, was kind of a little bit of a feminist. I was thinking about keeping my own name. And I just remember him saying to me, he said, you know, how would you feel if your mum had a different name to you? And I thought, oh, yeah, it's kind of a good point. So ended up taking his name. And I have to say, when I got the book deal, the designers at Simon & Schuster, my publisher, were like, yes, you know. So two short names fit straight across the jacket. Yeah, so I kind of lucked into that.
Destiny.
Absolutely. So you were talking about always having wanted to be a writer. What, did you write things when you were a kid? Did you write journals?
Yes, yeah, both of those things. I mean, I think I've written stories ever since I can remember, you know, sort of little poems and stories and songs, you know. I remember when I was very little, I used to write stories that would have a sad ending. I think it freaked my parents out a little bit, but I just hated the idea of people just thinking, oh, she's just a kid, you know, she's not going to surprise me. And so I'd sort of always write really sad things. And it's funny, I guess, an evolution of maybe having children myself. You know, most of my books do have kind of like an uplifting ending now. You know, I don't like the idea of leaving it on a sour note.
And are you still learning? Do you think Victoria said she's still learning? She hopes her writing's getting better. Do you
feel
the same? Yeah,
yeah. I think my family and friends have said, you know, that they can see the evolution of my books as they go on, you know, and so yeah definitely.
Do you sort of yearn after writing? She's Victoria's talking about always writing about Greeks or the Greek, you know, or getting into just that's what gets her imagination going. I mean, can you see yourself ever writing something completely different, like historical fiction, or, you know, just going in a different direction?
I'm not sure about historical fiction. I love reading it, but all that research, just the idea that she's like doing so much research into it. Well done.
Yeah, before she gets even started. Yeah.
Yeah, my research is going on a lovely summer holiday.
That
and so
good.
They're thinking, well, you know, what would the heroine be thinking if she was sitting here in this rooftop bar with the swimming pool in front of her? Oh, well, I'll just write about that, you know.
So. Going to find the sexy scuba dive guy and yes. having yeah. a chat with him.
Yeah, exactly.
That's good research.
It's yeah. difficult work in being an author.
And so what are you writing at the moment? What's your next book about?
Well, I'm writing my YA book, my young adult one, which is the series about the teenage girl who finds out that her father's a rock star. And then straight after that, I'll be writing my chick lit book, my next one for next year. And that's called 13 Weddings. And it's about a wedding photographer who falls in love with a groom. So, you know, we'll see. I'm not sure. I'm actually genuinely not sure how that book's going to end, because in my head, it might be the book that she doesn't get the guy. So I might kind of wing it at the end and just see where the character sort of takes me.
I was going to ask you about any fine lines between sort of fact and fiction. We've had memoir writers in here before talking about going into fiction. I mean, do any of your friends ever say, hang on a minute, that I said that to you, or I've seen, you know, or see themselves, because you can't really help it as a writer, can you, using your life?
I don't know. I make a quite concerted effort not to do that. I've had characters in the past, you know, who might have had a dad who was like such and such, and then I've suddenly thought, hang on, didn't that happen to my friend? And I've had to completely rewrite it so it doesn't reflect anyone's real life, because I really hate the idea of upsetting anyone. Yeah, and I think it's like my mum-in-law, you know, I'd hate her to sort of think, is that what she really thinks of me, you know, if I'm writing about a sort of mean mother-in-law. So I'm quite conscious not to make any of my books like real people.
And you do use Cambridge a bit. I think in one of your books you write about Angela Ruskin, in fact, where
yeah.
both me and Lee went
oh, wow.
to do our MAs. And you did some research, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I went and spoke to three students from Angela Ruskin who were lovely, really made me want to go back to university, actually. And that was my last book, One Perfect Summer. And we moved to Cambridge at the point in the story that the heroine moves to Cambridge. And it was just, I can't tell you how magical it was researching the city that had just become home. Because I always feel like, you know, because I have to put myself in the heroine's shoes, I kind of feel like, you know, those places that I write about have a little piece of home in them for me now too. Whereas with Cambridge, it really was home. And it was just incredible. You know, I still walk over, you know, the bridges in Cambridge and kind of can almost imagine my character sort of punting or on the river, or the guy that she sort of, one of the guys she falls for, you know, sitting on the corner of Trinity Bridge, you know, and
yeah,
reading his book.
Place.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Paige. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio. Best of luck with your young adult series and your next book.
Thank you.
On the next show, we're going
non-fiction, aren't we?
We are. We're going hardcore non-fiction, historical.
Non-fiction.
I spoke to Louise Foxcroft for that show, the writer of Calories and Corsets, a fascinating look at the history of diets, and it illuminates that we've been peddled the same stuff for centuries, but it's really interesting. And Lee.
I spoke to Claire Mully, and she's written a book about Christine Granville, who was a fantastic World War II secret agent. I mean, it's like reading a James Bond novel, but this was all real, and she's researched that. And in the studio, we've got Sarah Wise, who's written three non-fiction books, most of them set in Victorian London, and most of them about lives affected by poverty, but they're all fascinating too. So join us then. Look at that, with a long...